If these migrants are willing to take this road, I don't even want to imagine what they're running away from.
Despite headlines about the perils of the journey north, some Central Americans see no other choice. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Spending on anti-Obamacare ads outpaced positive ads by 15 to 1 during the first open enrollment period, to great effect.
The more they know that such a service exists.
This month, the World Health Organization endorsed a groundbreaking drug that can cut HIV infection by 99%. But some AIDS activists aren't celebrating.
We're working off of 30 years of being drummed into our heads that if you have sex, you will die. Then comes along a pill that changes our entire notion about safe sex.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The past several weeks have seen a surge in coverage of the crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, where upwards of 52,000 migrant children have been apprehended by U.S. Customs and Border Protection since October. The media abound with critics of immigration reform who say the influx is proof that the administration's bleeding heart policies are to blame. Here's political commentator Dinesh D'Souza Tuesday on Fox News.
So why is this occurring now? Are there revolutions swirling across Central America that are coughing up refugees? No, nothing has changed over there. What has changed is over here. The Obama administration for the past 6 years has been signaling that it's not serious about enforcing the immigration laws.
But Carlos Dada, co-founder and editor of the El Salvador newspaper El Faro, says that, in fact, something has changed, a long, slow change now at a tipping point, and that the U.S. critics are completely missing the point.
Children are not going to the United States because they think the United States has what you call heart-bleeding policies, because they still have to go through this hellish path, which is Mexico, which is not a joke, and which very few people survive.
So adults are in the United States. They've been there in various states of legality for years. Their kids are still in El Salvador and facing uncertain futures. And the parents finance this extraordinarily dangerous trip north. You have documented that perilous path. Tell me about your coverage.
We decided 5 years ago that we needed to cover that path. So we installed a special unit in Mexico City that included a reporter, Oscar Martinez, a photographer, Edu Ponces, and a documentarist, which is Marcela Zamora, to live in Mexico and document what was going on there. What we found was that people that were traveling by themselves, when they had just gotten to Oaxaca, which is still south of Mexico, 80% of women had already been submitted to sexual harassment or being raped. Lots of immigrants were already assaulted, robbed, killed, kidnapped, and that the drug cartels also wanted a piece of the big business that is illegal smuggling. So they were kidnapping by hundreds every day and asking for money to their relatives in the United States. If they didn't pay, they would get killed.
One of the main conduits through Central America is a freight train, which has been called La Bestia, the Beast. Did Martinez and Ponces ride that train?
Yes, they did, several times.
And their stories were dramatic and horrifying. What effect did your coverage have on the government and on the readership?
I think it had a certain impact, especially among Mexican authorities, which in the end confessed that all their migration services were very corrupt because the state was unable to fight all these big gangs and all these big cartels. What impact did it have in El Salvador? Well, not much, because their relatives or their friends have already done this road before. So this was not new for them. This was new basically for decision makers. And it was like an awakening for them to discover what was really going on and what our nationals would have to go through aiming for a better life.
On this side of the border, there's a lot going on. There is, of course, the Border Patrol just absolutely inundated there's the political battle over immigration reform, and then there is the propaganda war, which the government is trying to wage, dissuade young people from undertaking this reckless journey. And it's taken many forms. One of them is this. Now, that song is not subtle. It is about a death train. There's been some criticism because that song is played in regular rotation on popular radio stations, and it evidently is quite well received by the audience, who don't realize that it was written, produced, and distributed by the U.S. government to influence, some would say manipulate, the audience. But you say it sort of doesn't really matter.
People already know what La Bestia is. People already know the perils. So will this kind of campaign stop them from going to the United States? No, I don't think so.
There's also a TV campaign from the U.S. government about the extraordinary danger of making this journey. Here's what one of the spots sounds like.
Gracias por hablar con mi mamá. Sigue diciendo que piense bien esto de irme para el norte. Que no es igual que antes.
Oh, dear God, this is a tearjerker. This teenage boy is writing a letter to his uncle thanking him for allowing him to make the journey north. And he says goodbye to his mother. And then what happens, Carlos?
Well, and then we see the kid dies in the desert. He can't keep walking, and he just lies there until his death. Let me put here a phrase that was said by a Mexican priest called Alejandro Solalinde, who runs a shelter for migrants in Oaxaca. He once said, if these migrants are willing to take this road, knowing everything they're risking, even their lives, I don't even want to imagine what they're running away from. And in the end, that is the problem. It's true, the road is really dangerous, and I don't know how many times we have to insist on this. The thing is that they are running away from a place because they don't think they could keep on living on the circumstances in which they are living.
If it is really futile for the government to send the message that people already understand, what can the U.S. government do in Salvador to help conditions at the source?
There was a meeting in Honduras, and the Honduran president said, maybe the United States could invest all that money in some kind of a mini Marshall Plan. He didn't explain that much, but it actually makes sense. Because in the end, the United States not only is getting the consequences of this situation, it's also in a way also responsible in part for this situation. Because we have gangs here that originated when the United States started a massive deportation program when our peace agreements were signed after our civil wars. When they came back here, they established here both Mara Salvatrucha and 18th Street Gang, which we didn't have before. But there's another source of violence, which is drug cartels. I want to be very careful because I don't want to blame the United States for the malfunctioning of our own political systems, but it was a United States decision to totally close the Caribbean drug routes, thinking that drug cartels could be better fought in the Central American corridor. The global battles are being fought in our territories with states, again, that are weak enough not to be able to face this huge problem, as are these drug cartels.
Apart from a mini Marshall Plan to lend some stability to the region, is there anything that gives you hope?
Well, if I didn't have hope, I couldn't go on doing the work everybody at El Faro does every day. I mean, we have hope that there's a lot of good people trying to do their best to build a more functional country.
Carlos, thank you very much.
Thank you again, Bob.
Carlos Dada is the founder and editor of El Faro.
this year, we covered the flood of anti-Affordable Care Act ads that aired right before the end of the first phase of enrollment. The administration needed to get millions of young people to sign up for coverage before a March 31st deadline, or else the law just wouldn't work. It was going to be tight. The ads got intense, even cartoonish.
All right, can you swing on over, scoot on down, and try to make yourself comfortable?
One notorious anti-Obamacare ad featured a creepy Uncle Sam giving patients terrifying internal exams. Spending on negative Obamacare ads eclipsed spending on positive ads by a remarkable 15 to 1. Did they have any impact? Neem Yuragi, a governance studies fellow at the Brookings Institute, says that, in fact, they did.
Anti-Obamacare ads increased the Obamacare enrollment number.
How is that possible?
There are basically two theories. The first one is that with the negative ads, citizens' awareness about this subsidized service increases. And the more ads they see, the more they know that such a service exists. So they will go and look for more information about the service. The other theory is that citizens who are exposed to overwhelming number of negative ads about Obamacare are more likely to believe that this service is going to be repealed by the Congress in the near future. So if a citizen thinks that this service, which is subsidized heavily by the government, is going to soon discontinue, he or she will have a higher willingness to go and take advantage of this one-time opportunity before it goes away.
However, there are a tremendous number of variables in why people sign up for the coverage. The cooperation of the state, the nature of the law in that state, the cost of the premiums, all this combined with the disastrous rollout of the website would seem to create a lot of confusion and uncertainty as to how you arrived at your conclusion. So tell me how the study worked and why you think the results got past all that noise.
What we did was that we took the per capita spending on the negative ads and studied its effect on the enrollment ratio in Obamacare. And to calculate the per capita ad spending, I simply divide the total amount of dollars spent on negative ads to the total residents of that state.
Then you went ahead and determined how many people out of those eligible for this kind of insurance, either the uninsured or those who have private insurance, actually went and got Obamacare.
Exactly. Let's say that there are 200,000 people out of a total of 1 million residents in that state who were eligible for Obamacare. And at the end of the first open enrollment period, 50,000 people out of those 200,000 people actually went and got Obamacare. The enrollment ratio in this state would be 50,000 divided by 200,000.
So how do you answer critics who say, how do you control for income? How do you control for the relative costs of all the premiums that they're paying?
The short answer is that we also measured as many variables as we could. So, for example, we accounted for the proportion of the residents living under the federal poverty line. We considered the effects of the private insurance premiums in our analysis. We are going to publish the reports very soon, and your audience would be able to access much more details about the effects of all of these variables that we mentioned.
Kentucky and Arkansas and North Carolina have tightly contested Senate elections coming up. There were far, far more ads in those states than, say, in New York, where there were hardly any. In those states, do your results hold up?
They do. And those states are among the states that actually represent a high number of Obamacare enrollees.
Uh-huh.
The point is that I think the opponents of the Obamacare did a strategic mistake by overwhelmingly airing negative ads, which led to the popularity of this service and higher enrollment. This is not a unique phenomenon. We have seen similar effects in other contexts. For example, there is a study in the Journal of Marketing Science published in 2010 by researchers from Wharton School and Stanford, and they show that the negative reviews at New York Times would increase the sales of the books of the unknown authors.
A bad review is better than no review at all.
Correct. The 50 Shades of Grey, you know, many of the reviews were negative. However, those negative reviews may have led to its popularity and increased sale.
Mm-hmm. I guess the heart has its reasons.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking about it, I'm somehow comparing Obamacare with 50 Shades of Grey. So I just remove that part, you know.
We are so not doing that unless you insist. Niamh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Glad to be on your show.
Niamh Yeragi is a governance studies fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Coming up, if a man shoots his wife and the media don't cover it, does it make a sound?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. Find out how LegalZoom can help you start and protect your business through incorporation, LLCs, nonprofits, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom has helped start over 1 million businesses and received an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. More information at LegalZoom.com. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Sunday in Connecticut, five people were wounded by a gunman outside of a nightclub. On Wednesday in Kentucky, a man was killed by a gunman at a welcome center before the shooter shot himself. On Thursday in Los Angeles, two people were killed and one wounded by gunfire in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven. These are just a few of the dozens of shootings that happened just this week. Mass shootings dominate the headlines, but you rarely hear about gun deaths like these. There was, however, the Gun Report, a New York Times blog that chronicled the everyday shootings in America. It was launched by Joe Nocera, an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, inspired by the mass shooting of children at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And it was co-written by Jennifer Massia, an editorial assistant. The blog ran from January 31, 2013, until June 5th of this year, after more than 350 posts. And it was a widely known feature of the Times. It even made it to the Senate floor, twice. Here's Illinois Senator Dick Durbin on May 15th of last year.
It is one thing when you hear the dry numbers about 87 Americans killed, 200 wounded every day by gun violence. But Joe Nocera's report goes beyond the numbers. It shares some of the details about the news reports of these shootings. For example, Mr. Nocera's report for Monday describes shootings that took place over this last weekend. The tally of shootings in America goes on to fill 19 paragraphs. Let me read just some of the descriptions of the shootings that took
place. Massia wrote about her experience with the Gun Report in an essay titled, Who Gets Shot in America? What I Learned Compiling Records of Carnage for the New York Times. She says Senator Durbin's recitation was a big moment.
It really hit home how much of a reach this was starting to have. It's depressing reading. I know that not everyone is going to read every detail. And that was his point on the Senate floor. 19 paragraphs in one weekend, one shooting per sentence. That's a lot of shootings.
How did you choose among them?
Well, I would Google shooting, man shot, woman shot, child shot, teen shot, and accidentally shot. You know, this was all day one coverage of shootings, so a lot of times the details aren't fleshed out. If there was no name and scant details, I had to skip over those. So each day, there'd be about 35 to 40 shootings that I would present. The children I always put at the top of the column. I hate to be cynical. Those draw readers in. I'd include just a few lines each. I wanted to give readers a snapshot of who these people were and how they came to be shot.
How much time did it take you to put this together?
Every day, it took me 4 hours from start to finish. I'd pick a topic to talk about, a kind of news analysis to top the report. And on the weekends, it took me 10 hours because that included Friday, Saturday, and Sunday shootings.
You do some news reporting on the issue. It didn't start that way, but it sort of morphed into that, right?
This whole thing started very small, and it grew organically. And Joe would give me the opportunity, for which I'm very grateful, to start writing some intros. And about a year ago, he ceded the project to me. He said, there you go. He taught me how to write in a Times voice, keep my opinion out of it, don't get too emotional. And it helped a lot because when you step back and just let the story tell itself, it just flows.
So what did you learn that you didn't know when you were doing this?
There is an economic component to this. A lot of cities that used to have bustling manufacturing hubs, for instance, are in decline. The suburbs are in decline. You have cities like Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Indiana, towns that are not like Chicago. You would not associate them with gun violence. But the economy is in decline. People are fleeing. And what's left behind are a lot of people who feel powerless, especially young men. One way to retain some power is to be packing heat. What surprised me most was a lot of gun victims were the result of arguments, a lot of times alcohol-fueled, mostly between the hours of 11 o'clock at night and 5 o'clock in the morning. A lot of arguments that led to shootings happened in bar parking lots, strip club parking lots. Things escalate very quickly. People go to their car, grab a gun, and they don't even realize the consequences of what's going to happen until the bullet leaves the chamber.
What were some of the most difficult entries for you to write?
Well, anytime we had a mass shooting, the domestic shootings. There was one instance where a man who'd just been diagnosed with cancer was in his bedroom and he was about to kill himself and his wife came in. Her sister was listening on the other side of the door and he shot her in the head and killed her. And right before he shot her, she said, "Don't do it, Phil. I love you." Also hardest was when I actually knew one of the murder victims. There were three expatriate Iranians who were shot and killed in Williamsburg. I sat down to put the finishing touches on that day's gun report, and I opened the New York Times homepage. He was the first victim, shot in the head, execution style.
Why?
A disgruntled former bandmate slash friend. Nobody knows why, because then he killed himself. And that's the hardest part. When it is a murder-suicide, there are just so many unanswered questions.
Now, why did the report end? The head of the editorial department, Andy Rosenthal, said that it had become repetitive. Gawker and others reported that basically it folded because you asked for a promotion.
We have a very strong union, the Newspaper Guild, and somebody told me that the work I was doing deserved a much higher pay grade.
You evidently met the contractual requirements that would mandate a promotion.
We had very contentious contract negotiations in 2012, and this was something the company signed. If you write over 2,500 words a month, and I was writing that a week, the company did not think that was higher level work. That is their argument. And when the union brought this to my attention, I actually wasn't there, but they met with the company's lawyer. That was June 3rd. And 2 days later, Joe told me he was ending the report. The timing was, let's just say I don't believe in coincidences.
Let's talk about the other principal coincidence. And that is that you ended up tasked with this job.
Yeah, it didn't hit me until a few months in. When I was 5 years old, the FBI came for my father. He had been to jail before I was born. And when I was a baby, he broke his parole. And he and my mother and I ran to California from New York and lived under fake names. The FBI caught up with us. He served 8 months on the parole violation and was released. And we went about our normal lives. My father was a carpet cleaner. I knew he was in prison, but I didn't know why. And in 2000, criminal records were going online. And I said, let me go to the New York State Department of Corrections website and look up his record. And even though it was from the 60s, there it was. I scrolled down and the crime of conviction was murder. He was sick with terminal lung cancer And I didn't feel like I could come to him with it, so I spoke to my mother and she told me the story. That when he was 26, he was connected to the mob, a good fella, if you will, not a made guy. He and his buddies ran a drug sales operation in Brooklyn. And one of them was informing to the cops, and he shot the man 5 times in a park in Brooklyn. Right before my mother died, she confessed that my father had actually killed others, and he wasn't arrested for it. And here I was, writing about victims like his. I thought, this is some kind of an atonement.
You wrote that you are not an anti-gun absolutist.
People do a lot of irresponsible things with guns. However, there are sensible gun owners out there who keep them locked up. And I understand as a single woman living in New York City that if somebody were to burst into my apartment, my first thought would be, where's a gun?
In one of your posts, you say, you know, and here's an actual case of self-defense. Women who had a gun, who shot an intruder with a rifle who'd pushed his way into their house.
That does happen where a quote-unquote good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun, but many times a home intruder will grab the gun and shoot the homeowner. You really can't predict that you're going to be an expert marksman your first time out. Even police officers shoot themselves and each other by accident.
And you've chronicled that too. Do you know how to shoot?
I went skeet shooting. Turns out I was an excellent shot. I had 5 out of 5, but the shotgun got very heavy and I couldn't continue the streak.
What do you experience now that the report is finished?
Right after the report was pulled, 2 officers in Las Vegas were killed by anti-government extremists who then committed suicide. There was a shooting at Seattle Pacific University and at a high school in Oregon, and it absolutely burned me not to cover it. But there are people who are filling in this gap. One such entity is the Gun Violence Archive, which is an almost real-time accounting of injuries and deaths, and they're sounding the drumbeat, statistically speaking, not anecdotally speaking always.
So you have the numbers, but the details, that was part of what was provided by the report. And now you get that if you want it.
Anyone can find it. It's all out there.
Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Macia is an editorial assistant at the New York Times and the author of Never Tell Our Business to Strangers.
Coming up, the digital kiss heard round the world.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For the whole of the 21st century, online gaming has revolved mainly along the lines of adventure and mayhem and living rooms. That being the province of The Sims, the life simulation game that allows you to simulate domesticity in exquisite digital detail. All in the game's nonsense language, Simlish.
Diddly octava. Neep neep. Bend a zibble.
Do nerd.
Uh-huh.
Released in the year 2000, the game struck a chord by allowing people to recreate their home lives or to embellish them online. And it gets pretty granular. Prior to The Sims' release, some of the game developer's employees referred to it as the toilet game because it allowed users to, you know, toil. The Sims went on to become the best-selling PC game series of all time, but it was almost never released. Writing for the New Yorker's Elements blog, Simon Parkin says the game was close to being shuttered altogether until a moment of serendipity at a gamer conference.
There's a big video game conference held annually in Los Angeles called E3. And in 1999, the publisher, which is one of the larger ones in the world called Electronic Arts, has a major booth. And The Sims game, they decided to tuck around the corner. So I think they were kind of just testing the game out with the press.
Now, game playing has quite a bit of unpredictability to it. Otherwise, there would be no game. So at these dog and pony shows like E3, publishers like EA kind of rig the games to limit the number of potential outcomes?
When the development teams are demoing the games for press, they generally want it to play out the same way with every group of journalists that come through so that they can show off the game in the best light. And they'll very often kind of pre-can animations so that it plays out the same each time and it just kind of has the appearance of being truly interactive and dynamic.
So now I get to ask the question that all interviewers want to be able to ask. And then what happened?
A group of journalists came in to see The Sims. The presentation was broken into three scenes, one of which was a wedding scene between two Sims characters. What had happened is the team hadn't had enough time to fully prepare the scene so that it would play out the same each time. And in this case, all of the members of the congregation in the wedding scene were dynamic in the sense that they could do anything. The people who were demoing the game didn't know how they were going to behave. And in one of the early showings, two of the women in the congregation turn to one another, and I guess somewhere in their AI code, they fall in love and make out with one another.
When you say AI, artificial intelligence, they're learning as the game is played out.
Yeah, they're making their own decisions for themselves away from human input.
What was the immediate effect?
This was 1999, so it was a few years before gay marriage was introduced anywhere in the States. So at the time, it was transgressive. And I guess the fact that it was two ladies that were kissing probably appealed to some of the demographic that were there. So word of mouth spread throughout the conference. And
Wait. Let's not be so coy. Gamers, it's an overwhelmingly male audience. And a very, very common male fantasy is the lesbian kiss.
I couldn't possibly comment.
I will give you plausible deniability.
Then, because there was a surge in interest in the game, EA, the game's publisher, decided to bring The Sims front and center for the rest of the show. There was a lot of media attention. And so that code that facilitated that was allowed to remain within the game.
Had I been witnessing this whole episode as it played out, I would have said to myself, Bob, I would have said, this has publicity stunt written all over it. You're sure that this was not, in fact, a manufactured episode?
I am pretty sure. The programmer who actually put the code into the game that allowed this to happen kind of told me that it was because he ran out of time. So if he could have made it so that there wasn't a true simulation during this presentation, he would have done so.
We're following the development of another game, Tamagotchi Life, which is, I guess, designed as a competitor to The Sims. Tell me about it, please.
Right. So Tamagotchi Life is a game created by Nintendo. It takes a similar approach to The Sims in which you can create a character and play out a day-to-day life, forming relationships, having romance, and even getting married. Same-sex relationships had been omitted from the game's code. There was widespread outcry about this decision. And they made the comment that they didn't want to make any social commentary with this game. They just wanted to make something that was fun, which, of course, then invited the rebuttal that that is a form of social commentary in and of itself.
Are they concerned that in Russia and other countries that are now sort of explicitly anti-gay, that they couldn't sell Tamagotchi Life?
Quite possibly. And indeed, the latest version of The Sims, The Sims 4, which is going to be released later this year, has just received an adult-only rating in Russia, reportedly because it features same-sex relationships.
I have one more question for you. Game publishing is sort of like Hollywood. And I know that if this had happened for, let's say, movie promotion and an unplanned homosexual kiss had redounded to the benefit of a release, the next thing that would have happened is every studio in Hollywood would have been making movies that included gay kisses. I'm curious whether that took place in the video gaming business.
I would say that the influence wasn't widespread in that sense. And there's, you know, a lot of calls for more diversity in terms of the kind of characters and the kind of relationships that we're seeing in video games. And I'd say in that sense, it's probably a little behind Hollywood, but it did have a great impact. After the story was published, there was a thread on the internet written by various people who were teenagers at the time that the game came out, sharing their stories about about how, you know, seeing same-sex relationships represented in the game allowed them to accept their own sexuality and explore it and understand themselves a little bit better. So as a result of that feedback, I absolutely think that calls for more diversity are, you know, not only valid but also important for the industry.
Simon, many thanks.
Thanks very much.
Writer and journalist Simon Parkin wrote about The Sims Kiss for The New Yorker's Elements blog. If, as Parkin says, The Sims Kiss hasn't led to a flood of gay characters and relationships in video games, that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of gay video game consumers. While there has been a renaissance in LGBT independent game development, many of those consumers don't find their lives represented in mainstream titles. Where is the will and grace of video gaming? Samantha Lee Allen writes about sexuality, gender, and video games for Borderhouse, a blog about games for the marginalized gamer. Samantha, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about the independents. There are a lot of titles out there.
Yeah, around in 2012, there was this sort of queer games renaissance. Anna Anthropy's game Dysphoria is often sort of hailed as one of the central games in that movement. It's a game where you play through Anna's experiences on hormone replacement therapy as a transgender woman. And sort of around Anna, there came up this whole scene of queer and transgender game designers who made games about marginalized experiences that weren't getting represented in mainstream games. Sort of on the other side of that fence, you have mainstream game development where you have large titles with budgets in the tens of millions of dollars, sort of massive games with fully realized worlds. The story on LGBT inclusion in those games is a little bit different.
There's one title, Mass Effect 3. Tell me about it.
Mass Effect 3 is an action role-playing game by BioWare, which is a Canadian developer owned by Electronic Arts, which is one of the major video game publishing houses. In Mass Effect 3, you have the option to engage in gay romances. You can play as either a male or a female protagonist. And for each protagonist, there are gay options.
And it can sound something like this.
It's been an unforgettable few years. And you were always so focused on the work back then. The mission was everything.
It's true. I'll never know what I missed. You're exactly what I need right now.
And what's the effect of content like this on the LGBT world?
Queer gamers blocked this content because it's so refreshing to finally see yourself, your desires, your romance reflected in high production value content. And so the tipping point that we're starting to see now are mainstream games like Dragon Age Inquisition.
With a character who is gay in the script, it's not the choice of the user.
Saying, no, we're going to unapologetically put LGBT content in our games, and you should engage with it and enjoy it.
And there's another game called Gone Home, which particularly intrigues me. Can you tell me about it?
Gone Home is a game in which you play as a young college-age girl who goes home, walks around her house, and learns through environmental context a story about her younger sister. Over the course of the game, you learn that your younger sister has been involved in a gay relationship and struggles to understand what that means for her, what that means for her friendship, what that means for her relationship with her parents.
I don't get Lonnie sometimes. Like, her band and our zine and her hair and everything are all anti-authority. But I watch her in JROTC and she's doing drills in perfect formation, following orders, no question. And there's all this stuff in the news about don't ask, don't tell. Like, she's going to join the army and then have to lie about who she is?
There was a tremendous response to Gone Home from game developers and critics because it got so many Game of the Year awards. Plenty of mainstream straight male gamers have played it and learned something about an experience that's not their own. And at the same time, you have folks like myself who've played it and seen their own experiences represented. And so we have this sort of common touchstone now going forward.
As opposed to the game Tomodachi Life, which has explicitly prohibited gay characters.
Yeah, and the press release that accompanied that decision They said, we're trying to create a playful alternate world. We're not trying to make any political commentary. People who are in gay relationships in their lives are saying LGBT lives are not a political statement. They're a social reality.
All right, Samantha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Samantha Allen writes about gender, sexuality, and video games. Her writing appears regularly for the gaming blog Border House and also in Salon, Huffington Post, Paste, and Polygon.
Late last week, the World Health Organization announced that HIV infections are rising among gay men in many parts of the world. While the annual number of new infections in the U.S. has dropped roughly two-thirds from its peak in the 80s, it now holds steady at 50,000 a year. We're still living in an epidemic. Now the focus in the fight is toward PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, to prevent infections rather than treat them after the fact. In May, a powerful endorsement for one specific PrEP was announced.
The CDC said hundreds of thousands of Americans at risk of AIDS should take a daily pill called Truvada. It has been shown to prevent HIV infections, and many insurers already cover it.
Studies have shown that Truvada, if taken daily, can cut the risk of contracting HIV by as much as 99%. Endorsed by the WHO this month, this should be huge news. But there's a catch. Many AIDS advocates, such as the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, worry that users won't necessarily take it every day and that widespread use of a drug that almost guarantees you won't get infected will lead to condomless sex and the spread of other diseases. Gawker staff writer Rich Jeswiak has been writing about Truvada for the past several months. He says there's a deeply rooted fear that holds Truvada back, particularly among groups that could benefit the most. If you're listening with young kids or otherwise easily offended, we'd like to let you know that there is some mild language about gay sex in this interview.
We're working off of 30 years of being drummed into our heads that if you have sex, you will die, that you have to protect yourself. You have to use a condom, 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 condom. And then comes along a pill that changes our entire notion about safe sex. And I think that a lot of people think that it's an easy way out. I mean, Larry Kramer called it cowardly.
Larry Kramer, AIDS activist, writer of The Normal Heart, opposes strenuously the use of Truvada to prevent infection.
Yes. He said that anybody who voluntarily takes an antiviral every day has got to have rocks in their heads. You're taking a drug that is poison to you, that has lessened your energy to fight, to get involved, to do anything. Now, Truvada is specifically prescribed because of its lack of side effects. It's one of the easiest antiretrovirals on your system.
Right, but that's not saying a lot. I mean, you had, at least initially, side effects when you took Truvada.
I did, and there is a kernel of truth in Larry Kramer's words because fatigue is one of the things that I experienced. Now, it wasn't constant fatigue. It's not clouding people's heads to the extent that if you're politically inclined, you're going to just forget everything because you're in a Truvada haze.
Does Truvada, in the research you've done, affect how often you use a condom?
The first thing I would say about that is that a lot of gay men don't use condoms. That there was a study in which it was over 5 years and one out of six gay men reported that he used a condom every time.
One out of six?
One out of six.
So it's not as if a perfect situation is being disrupted by Truvada.
Exactly. Truvada is sort of something we need in addition to condoms.
As I was reading the argument over Truvada, the kind of coverage and the lack of coverage and the prevailing narratives and the debate, I was thinking of all sorts of other kinds of drugs. For instance, the debate over e-cigarettes and the coverage is that it will once again normalize smoking, and that will be bad for the general population, because they don't want to change people's prevailing attitudes towards cigarettes by introducing the e-cigarette into the world as an unstigmatized object. I mean, if you think about all the arguments about pot over the years, especially medical marijuana, because of the concern of normalizing it. And then you have this, where the stakes are huge, life and death.
Right. The most convincing concern people have is that if everybody gets on Truvada, or everybody's on antiretrovirals because they're positive or negative, and everybody starts having condomless sex as they did in the 70s, then what we're doing is we're creating a pool in which another unknown microbe can rise up and start attacking us. We also have to worry about antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea, for example. So I do think that that sort of pressure maybe helps keep people in check in a certain way. But absolutely, this can be something that's useful. I mean, HIV is the big one, right?
If it turns out that the side effects are negligible, why wouldn't gay men not in a long-term monogamous relationship just take it the way people take baby aspirins to prevent heart attacks? Why aren't there headlines that say, hooray, taken every day, a cure for AIDS?
Because we have this cultural baggage of shame and of the devastation that AIDS caused because of the way that we regard AIDS and HIV just needs to change. Personally, I'm so glad that I have this thing in my system that makes me worry about my life a little bit less, and I'm trying to do the best I can with that.
Some of us may remember that when the birth control pill was introduced, it seemed like there were headlines everywhere, Life magazine, cover stories. But the fact is, when Searle, the drug company, applied for FDA approval in 1957, it was presented as a drug to treat menstrual disorders in the full knowledge that its major use would be to prevent pregnancy. Searle would not market it as a birth control drug because it didn't believe it could. After that, we saw an epidemic of menstrual disorders. I mean, when you talk about stigma, it's really a proxy argument, right? Back then, freedom from pregnancy equaled women's liberation. Right now, Truvada suggests liberation from the fear of death.
Yes. And it comes at a time where marriage equality is at the forefront of conversation about gay people. And so much strategy in that is saying, we are just like you. We're not crazy sex fiends. The idea that this drug could come along to facilitate what is seen as risky, if not destructive behavior, i.e. sex without condoms, confounds that, and then people get worked up. The moral judgment that comes along with sex is just insane, and AIDS just confirmed what a lot of people believed, that gay people had it coming to them, that their sex was deviant and wrong, and hey, look, this proves that. A little red Huffington Post article by David Duran was called Truvada Whores, with a question mark, and this was written in 2012. Castigates people for enjoying raw sex.
Meaning without condoms.
Without a condom. Which is like, have you had sex? Because it's better without condoms. Unless you're a latex fetishist, I don't think that you're going to disagree with me. But this created such a ripple that Truvada Whores is now on t-shirts. It's mentioned in basically every New York Times article, but it so perfectly crystallizes the way that gay men talk to each other, the hypocritical judgment that we cast upon each other. And look, this is a huge unlearning that we all have to do as a culture.
Unlearning? You
know? Unlearning, yes.
But HIV still exists. It still can kill you.
It absolutely does. But at least for me, for a child of the 80s, I watched AIDS on PSAs, on TV shows, as a death sentence. 1996 comes along, antiretroviral cocktails, protease inhibitors, the notion of being undetectable comes along.
An undetectable viral load, and with it, the likelihood that you will live much longer.
Live much longer, also are not nearly as contagious to the point of not being contagious at all, perhaps. So in effect, the most mind-blowing thing to me when I got out of my 10-year relationship in 2012 and had to learn all this about HIV is that the most contagious guys are the guys who don't know that they have HIV and aren't on meds. So a guy who's going to tell you I'm positive is, in fact, in theory, safer than a guy who says I'm negative because he just doesn't know. What I love about Truvada, though, is that for the first time in history, sexually active gay men can say with certainty, I am negative.
Can you tell me then how in 2012, the narrative that you grew up with, that was presented in countless sex education classes and in ads and on posters and throughout the media, how that narrative shifted?
Personally, for me, it was through Grindr.
A social app that enables you to hook up with gay men, you know, pretty much, you know how many feet away they are.
Yeah, it's GPS-based. Yeah. That's the real technology of it. Yes, it was through Grindr that Positive Guys schooled me, causing me to look into this more. So it took a lot of unlearning and research for me to be comfortable enough after watching AIDS be the murderer for so many years to understand that it's not necessarily so much like that anymore. It's no walk in the park. I don't want HIV. That's why I'm on Truvada right now.
Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Rich Jezwiak is a staff writer for Gawker. He wrote about Truvada and gay culture in his series on the site called Pride and Shame.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Meera Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Ribbon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.